Welcome to the penultimate episode of The Political Rewind. I'm Madhani Muturi, and yes, next week, The Rewind will end its short and glorious run. But you can still get your fix of politics at NPR's It's All Politics podcast at npr.org. But for today, a newspaper man turned banker? We take a look at the president's new car guy. And before all that, Obama's Unbush Euro Tour ends.
The Obama administration announced today that it is going to join group talks with Iran over its suspected nuclear program. President Bush generally left those talks to the Europeans, so today's announcement is yet another change from the previous administration. And that was the big theme of President Obama's just-completed trip to Europe. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports on what Mr. Obama and the U.S. got out of that trip.
It's an unusually quiet day at the White House. No public events, no briefings. President Obama presumably slept in after returning home at 3 a.m. Midway through his trip, the president gave himself this report card.
Well, I think we did okay.
On one level, the trip was a triumph. Throughout his marathon of speeches, town meetings, summits, and one-on-one talks with foreign leaders, Mr. Obama received fawning media coverage. He was greeted with enthusiasm by European leaders and was extremely popular with ordinary people. Bob Kagan is a foreign policy expert at the Carnegie Endowment. He says the trip was a personal success for the president.
He was out there on the world stage and clearly appears to be much beloved in the world, which I think Americans were yearning for. I think it always makes Americans uncomfortable if they think that the vast majority of the world is hostile or unhappy with them.
It can be politically risky for an American president to travel abroad when there's a recession at home. And Mr. Obama is about to leave again next week for visits to Mexico and the Caribbean. But so far, the president's travels seem only to have helped him at home, says White House aide Bill Burton.
We noticed but aren't guided by the polls, but I did notice that his approval ratings did go up while he was abroad. And I think it's because the American people recognize that there has been a change in leadership that is going to change the way America deals with other countries and whether or not we are going to be able to get things out of those relationships with our allies.
And that's the big question, whether or not Mr. Obama can turn his popularity overseas into real leverage with our allies. He did get a few results last week, a new framework for international financial regulations and billions more in IMF loans. But, says Bob Kagan,
so far the Obama administration is pushing on a lot of open doors. They're offering others what the others are happy to receive, a less unilateral America, arms control negotiations, which the Russians do want, talks with the Iranians, which the Europeans want to see. The question will come when we're asking people to do things that they didn't want to do. Will there be any leverage to get them to do that? And I think there's reason to be skeptical.
On his big priorities, Mr. Obama couldn't convince the Europeans to commit many more troops in Afghanistan or more economic stimulus. And on Guantanamo, he only got the French to commit to taking one lone prisoner. But President Obama's top political advisor, David Axelrod, told reporters that's the wrong way to look at this trip. Just putting our diplomatic relations back on a positive footing is achievement enough. Big tangible gains will come later.
Why didn't the waters part, the sunshine, and all ills of the world disappear because President Obama came to Europe this week? That wasn't our expectation. That'll take at least a few weeks.
Jokes aside, that is the White House premise, that if the president shows some deference and humility to U.S. partners now, he can win their cooperation down the road on issues like climate change, the global economy, or nuclear proliferation. Take the Russians. The president is embarking on a new round of arms control negotiations, a top Russian priority, in the hopes that later the Russians may put pressure on Iran. P.J. Crowley was a national security aide in the Clinton White House.
Clearly, if you're able to make progress in one portion of the nonproliferation portfolio, it can have broader benefits. No guarantee, but I think that's a reasonable strategy to take.
And a necessary one. While on some issues, like the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. can conceivably shoulder the burden alone. But there is no acceptable unilateral solution to the Iranian nuclear threat. President Obama will have to find a way to get the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese to help him put pressure on the Iranians if they are to be dissuaded from their nuclear weapons program. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
A government program to help auto parts makers is now up and running.
The program's designed to keep paychecks flowing to more than 500,000 people who work for the parts suppliers. It's part of the Obama administration's larger plan to bail out the troubled auto industry. The administration has given General Motors and Chrysler just a few weeks to come up with survival plans if they want billions more in government help. The task force overseeing those plans is run by a man with little automotive experience but a knack for making money and connections. And NPR's Scott Horsley has this profile.
In late summer of 1979, a story appeared in the New York Times under the byline of a young reporter named Stephen Ratner.
Official Washington has begun informally debating the Chrysler Corporation's request for up to $1 billion in federal aid.
30 years later, Ratner is running President Obama's auto industry task force, and he's helping the administration to answer the question he first posed in the late 1970s.
Whether it is obligatory or even desirable for the federal government to come to the rescue of a large ailing corporation.
Ratner had joined the New York Times fresh out of Brown University, where he studied economics. He began as an assistant to the legendary Times editor, James Reston, and he advanced quickly. But in the early 1980s, Ratner left journalism for the more lucrative world of investment banking. He worked at Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley, and Lazard Frere before co-founding his own investment firm, Quadrangle Capital, 9 years ago. Ratner specialized in media companies. He managed the personal fortune of media mogul turned New York mayor Michael Bloomberg. But aside from covering the first Chrysler bailout 30 years ago, Ratner didn't know much about the auto business. When he took over the task force, United Auto Workers president Ron Gettelfinger grumbled about answering to a non-car guy. But industry expert Susan Helper of Case Western Reserve says Ratner and his colleagues are quick studies.
These are very, very smart people, and they learn very fast.
At the same time, Helper takes issue with Ratner's statement in a number of newspaper articles that setting policy for GM and Chrysler is essentially an investment decision, much like those he made in his banking career.
There are some ways in which it is an investment decision. I think no one wants to see these companies flounder for a long time. On the other hand, I think the public has different goals.
Helper suggests that in order to justify a public investment in the auto industry, there must be a public payoff, such as preserving high-wage jobs or building more fuel-efficient cars, things that don't necessarily enter into an investment banker's bottom line. As a banker, Ratner made a lot of money, enough for a lavish apartment on Fifth Avenue and his own airplane. He also gave away a lot of money to Democratic politicians. His wife, Maureen White, is the former national finance chair for the Democratic National Committee. The couple raised more than $100,000 for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, then shifted their support to Barack Obama once he sewed up the nomination. Ratner declined NPR's request for an interview, but he told Bloomberg last month that fixing GM and Chrysler would take sacrifices all around.
We are certainly going to ask for all stakeholders, including the UAW, to make concessions as part of this process.
That includes tough medicine for management. Ratner personally gave GM boss Rick Wagner his walking papers, and the government says creditors who lent money to the two companies aren't likely to get much of it back. The administration has warned that unless a deal can be struck voluntarily in the next month or two, bankruptcy may be the best option for the automakers. Ratner told Bloomberg that tight timelines like that have a way of bringing people to the table.
I think inevitably, as part of this process, there are going to be deadlines. I've been working on deals for 26 years, and without deadlines, deals don't happen.
The clock is ticking for members of the auto task force as well, although Ratner reportedly has ambitions of staying on in the Obama administration. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
It's the Political Rewind. I'm with Ani Mutturi. Finally today, the presidential Passover.
Why is this night different from any other night? Well, for one, it may be the first time a sitting president holds a Passover Seder in the White House. Here's NPR's Robert Smith.
Let's clear up those internet rumors right now. President Barack Obama is not a secret Jew, although
we'd be happy to have him.
Rabbi Michael Friedman from New York Central Synagogue says tonight is historic, but Mr. Obama should remember not to make it too formal.
First of all, have fun with it.
And make it your own, the rabbi says. The Seder commemorates the Jewish exodus from Egypt after centuries of slavery. And Rabbi Friedman says that, in a way, the themes of Passover are the original Yes, We Can.
That we have to take action. We have to take our lives into our own hands. We have to reach out and change the world.
Today at sundown, the Obama family will gather with Jewish staff in the White House and have the traditional meal of the matzah, the bitter herbs, the roasted egg. They'll also remember the plagues of ancient Egypt, the locusts, the frogs, boils, and maybe pause to contemplate the modern curses upon this country, foreclosures, unemployment, AIG. Rabbi Friedman says that President Obama could take a cautionary lesson from how the Egyptian pharaoh handled those tough times.
The pharaoh, after each plague, got tougher and more obstinate and less willing to let the Jews, the Israelites, go to freedom. And I think President Obama faces the challenge of doing the exact opposite, to remain open-hearted to all the citizens of the United States and the citizens of the world.
The Seder is already being dissected for its political meaning. It comes conveniently just after the president traveled to a Muslim country and just before the annual Easter egg roll. And it does fulfill a campaign promise. Last year, at the end of a Seder attended by then-candidate Obama, after the traditional refrain, "Next year in Jerusalem," he said, "Next year in the White House." Tonight, perhaps the president should say, "Next year in economic recovery." Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
Thanks for listening to The Political Rewind, and a heads up to our faithful, The Rewind is closing up shop. Next week, we post our final episode. But fear not, you can still get your fix with NPR's politics podcast, It's All Politics, at npr.org.